Dave Fanning on 2FM.
2FM. What made you take on David Bowie? What is it that you saw in him, and when did you see it?
Well, I met David about a month after I met Mark, and it was through our mutual publisher, David Platts at Essex Music. They had a problem with David Bowie's image. You know, they didn't really know what he was and how they could market him. His very first album was kind of all over the place. And when I heard it, I told David Platts that it was. And he said, well, would you like to meet him? And I said, well, yeah, he's great. He sounded like a very intelligent, very talented young man. And I said, of course I'd like to meet a person like that. And it was a setup. David was actually in the next room, waiting to meet me.
Because, like, no, but when you say, like, the very first album, it depends on, like, people will go back as far as Davy Jones and the Lower Third, which I don't think I know an awful lot about. They go back to 1964 nearly. But to me, the first album was Space Oddity. Is that the one you're talking about?
The first album was Man of Music or something.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He had songs like Uncle Arthur and Mr. Gravedigger and all those strange...
Because Space Oddity is a brilliant album. I think Space Oddity is one of his best.
I know. I wish I was a better producer then. I mean, every time I hear that, I roll my eyes and I said, I wish I did this, I wish I did that. But it's a great album.
Oh,
great.
I mean, things like The Signet Committee and Memory of a Free Festival and all that, and God Knows I'm Good, brilliant songs.
Brilliant songs, I agree.
Yeah, okay, now, so the next album is the one we want to take a look at, which is this one. Just how important, for instance, was Mick Ronson in all of this? Like, was he... I know he was an accomplished musician, and he was able to play violin and piano. Was he able to, you know, react to, even later in life, a string quartet and a woodwind arrangement and all that? Was he that much better than I might have thought than just some long-haired guitarist?
Well, you're absolutely right. He kept surprising us. We realized when we did the Space Oddity album that we didn't know enough about rock music. And at the time, you could only really get gigs if you were a rock band, you know, if you made a big sound. I don't know how we were introduced to Mick, but when we met him and we heard him play, we looked at each other. Simultaneously, we knew that he had to be in our band. And, of course, I was the bass player. And so Mick came to us and played for one day and maybe stayed overnight, and the next day we did a live show for John Peel, and that was the first time we ever played together. It was a lovely recording. It still exists. But he was our mentor in all things rock. He showed me how to play bass like Jack Bruce, and he could turn up the volume to 11, you know, which was a thing that we feared at the time.
It's probably the rockiest, if that's the right word for it, album that David Bowie ever made.
It's kind of a heavy rock album. It's also an art album because those songs weren't normal rock songs.
No.
I mean, there's so many damn chords in those songs. I have a hard time remembering them. But it was very complicated, and we were so brave about it. We thought we were going to change the world with this music. But Bowie was always ahead of his time until he caught up with himself. So I think about 10 people bought the album.
Right, but
it did
change the world later on in so many ways, because so many people who love David Bowie will go back to that album and say it's their favourite. I mean, just take a track like She Shook Me Cold. You had a Moog on that, isn't that right? And at the time, that was what? Was it revolutionary or cool?
It was very cool. I think hardly anyone used it, and we borrowed, rented, I suppose, George Harrison's Moog. And it came along with Chris Thomas, the young producer at the time, who's the only one in London who knew how it worked. But we love that sound from the Wendy Carlos albums, and it wasn't used in a rock context yet. And I think we were among the first to do that.
Yeah, and then it became huge with all the kind of progressive rock bands and all the rest of it as well. Okay, well then let's take a look then. Like, can I go jump very far forward? I mean, just to the recent comeback of David Bowie, which is the biggest bit of news. Like, every time between 2004 and 2012, we were all going, you know, the big thing is to get an interview with David Bowie or find out what David Bowie is doing. He's doing a John Lennon. He's completely gone out of the picture altogether. And suddenly this thing creeps back. Now let's see how suddenly it was. To us, it was sudden because one day we woke up and there was a single with an album to follow. But with you, you're in the studio with Kaiser Chiefs. What happened?
Well, I was in Kaiser Chiefs and I got a phone call. I was in London recording for Kaiser Chiefs and I got a phone call from New York where David lives. And he said, how would you like to make some demos with me? He starts every album with demos, you know, not sure that it's going to be an album. And this happened so many times, I immediately took it as, let's start an album. And I was shocked. I was hardly in touch with David. He really went silent for about almost 10 years. So as soon as I got back to New York, I was in the demo studio on the bass, and we had a couple of other musicians with us, and we started making demos for the next day.
And they were just demos, but you didn't necessarily know they were for an album called The Next Day, or did you?
Oh, no. Like most albums, the title comes at the very, very end, when you understand what you do, what you've just recorded.
By the way, the best song on the album for me is the single, which I think is one of the best things he's ever done. But was it, do you think, a bit of a surprise as a single? I mean, he didn't come back with a bang. It's kind of, I didn't want to say he came back with a whimper, but he came back with something quite meditative.
I know we had quite a few rock songs in the batch, but he came on with that "Where Are We Now," which I think was so beautiful, and it was so honest and excruciatingly beautiful. On hindsight, it made sense to start out with that because, of course, everyone would want to hear a rock song from David Bowie, and he just always does the opposite, and he's always right. I have to say.
51552 is our text. We're here till 1 o'clock, between 12 and 1, a special interview with David Bowie and his music as well. For this hour, it's his producer, Tony Visconti, that we're talking to at the moment. He produced that album, actually, The Next Day, and the Black Star album released just last week. And he does hark back lyrically in that song to Berlin and the time he had there, which I get the impression. It must have been, people refer to those albums all the time. The amount of people that have been influenced by the albums. U2 went there, of course, with the Rock Tongue Baby album as well, and definitely influenced by the fact that the three Berlin albums, which, by the way, weren't all recorded in Berlin at all, as you well know, that time, was it a golden time for you?
It was, and Berlin was such an unlikely place to make a record because it was still recovering from World War II. It was a stark city, and anyone who was there making art of any kind was kind of involved 100% in the art, not making money. That wasn't the issue. And it was a very fertile environment to be creative. And it just worked for us. It just worked. I don't think it worked for people who went there after us because it was changed by then. It changed, but it was the most unlikely place to make a record.
And when you say making art and not money, can I jump forward to the fact that years later you went back with David Bowie with The Heathen and all the rest of it and Reality, etc. Do you think that the most important thing for David then was that he wanted commercial success, but artistic integrity is much more important?
I think artistic creativity was much more important to him all the time.
Yeah.
But I think he had a knack of doing both things. But he wouldn't do anything crassly commercial just for the sake of it. I mean, he finally mastered the art of doing something incredibly brilliant, and then it was also a commercial success. I mean, I don't know how he pulls it off all the time, but he does.
And if you were with him for the 10 or 12 years of his best albums of all, and then came back to him later on as well in the 90s, if you take the 80s out of the picture with you and David, which it kind of was for the two of you, when he came back, did you find that he had sort of more ideas about certain things to do with music, like harmonic and sort of chordal structures and all that kind of thing, that his knowledge had improved? Or do you think he had been a bit lazy in the 80s and he needed you back to give him another hoosh up the ladder?
I don't know about that, but he was always interested in jazz, always, and if you're a guitarist and you try to play a Bowie song at a party, it's just impossible because it's the most unlikely bunch of chord changes. Mm. He was that way back when I met him, but of course, over the years, he got smarter and smarter about music, and on the next day, we pulled off some amazing stunts, really brilliant sounds and harmonic changes and bass lines. Everything was really, really, really good. But, we got together on Heathen, actually. Heathen is the first album that we did after a long, long period of not working together. And there you go. I mean, half those songs have jazz chord changes on them.
As the producer then, would you go back and say, look, it had to start somewhere, and definitely, speaking of the Beatles, George Martin, modern recording production starts with him?
Absolutely. He is my idol. Because I took classical guitar lessons and I played in a symphony orchestra when I was in high school. And then I was a rock musician. And I said, I don't fit anywhere. I don't fit in. I didn't know who I was. And as soon as I knew who George Martin was, I said, that's what I do. I do what that chap does, And I've been guided by him all my life, all my musical career.
And do you think almost definitely the Beatles, whoever they were, as the quartet or whatever, that they would have gone elsewhere or gone in a different direction or not gone maybe in such a hugely fantastically brilliant direction, possibly, if it wasn't for so many things that George Martin has? Let's put it down to two things: care and skills.
Well, I agree, Dave. I think after their first flush of success, if George Martin didn't help them into like the revolver,
the rubber soul revolver, yeah, exactly.
And they would have been not as famous, and I'm pretty certain about that. I mean, George Martin has been credited by them,
yeah,
a bit condescendingly, but without him, they wouldn't have been the Beatles that we know and love today.
Okay, well, look, I'm going to let you go, but before I do, just let's get back to this finally. Just one last thing about David Bowie, actually, sorry, about which is this. Do you find that David Bowie, like, were songs written before he comes into the studio, or is it true that songs like Fame or Fashion or Under Pressure or Heroes, that they actually come from just jamming themselves into existence in the studio?
He comes in with ideas. Like, he does work on a song. He's got a bit of a format. And then we do jam on it a little bit, and he might have a working title, at which in the end it will not be that title, and it won't be about that subject either. So he's one of the few people I know who can do that. He's very, very quick in the studio, and he believes in giving musicians their head. You know, he lets them do what they do best rather than dictate every single note. Half the songs on the next day were written. He came in with lyrics,
right?
But the other half, you know, maybe with jams, you know.
And that's the voice of Tony Visconti we're talking about there. He's in Dublin this weekend for the Dublin Bowie Festival, taking place at the moment. Lots of events, and tonight's the Olympia. And Tony Visconti and Spiders from Mars drummer Woody Woodmansey, the band Holy Holy, they're going to perform The Man Who Sold the World and Ziggy Stardust. And then tomorrow, the two of them, Tony Visconti and Woody Woodmansey, are going to be speaking at an event at the Royal College of Surgeons. It's called Face to Face with The Man Who Sold the World.
Dave Fanning on 2FM. 2FM.